How is climate change reshaping Miami Beach? And will we eventually lose any chance to have affordable housing in coastal cities? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
They don't want anybody speaking out and saying it. It's your fault. You should be asking for affordable housing.
There was once a time when Miami Beach was affordable, but times have changed and demand for beachfront property has driven a lot of people out of cities like Miami Beach for decades. Now the threat of sea level rise might make it almost impossible to have affordable housing. We'll check into a new investigation on climate risk and the future of coastal living. But first, the Electoral College will be voting today for a new president. We'll hear from one of the electors out of Broward County. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, after weeks of lawsuits and unfounded claims of election fraud, the Electoral College finally meets today to vote for the new president-elect. In what historically has been a straightforward process in previous elections, today's ceremony has been surrounded in controversy as President Trump and many Republicans in Congress refuse to acknowledge President-elect Biden's victory. Chevron Jones is a Democrat state senator based in Broward County. He's also a delegate for the Florida Democratic Party as part of the Electoral College, and he joins us now. Mr. Jones, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me, Lewis.
You know what? Just remind us quickly how the Electoral College in Florida works and the part that you're playing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So the governor chooses from a list submitted by the executive committee of each political party, and the parties base their selections on basically like party loyalty. So on the Democrats list, for instance, you have Commissioner of Agriculture Nikki Freed, myself, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. On the Republican list, you have individuals like Representative Randy Fine of Brevard County and Joe Gruters, who is the chairman of the Florida Republican Party from Sarasota. So basically each party select who they want to be electors.
And let's be clear, you won't be voting today because President Trump took all of Florida's delegates, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. So the popular vote within Florida, the Republicans won. So therefore, those 29 electors will elect President Trump as the winner of Florida.
Have you spoken with any electors in states that were won by Joe Biden, whether they would be willing to defy the vote of the people? I mean, is that a legitimate possibility?
I have not spoken to anyone to that instance. I know that it's a real thing that's actually happening right now, but I haven't spoken to anyone.
So, as you know, the president has been trying in the courts to undo this election. He has a lot of people in Congress and in different states that have backed him on this effort. Is that making things uncomfortable or difficult, you know, before today, as you're going into today, or just in general?
Well, the problem, Lewis, is that when you look at what the president and other Republicans are doing and totally trying to derail democracy, it's dangerous. It's going into this and for them to totally cast out the votes of millions of Americans, all because you weren't happy with the elections. And but mind you, the same people who are saying that President Trump won, this was a stolen election, and some of them won on that same ballot. So is your election fraud also? And so it's unfortunate that we have come to this point in them trying to derail our democracy, all because they lost.
Do you think it's dangerous, or do you think that maybe people look until January 20th, you know, you may hear a lot of this rhetoric and you may hear this anger, but do you think that it's really dangerous to our electoral system, or that maybe, you know, people will just calm down after a while and we're just going to move on with our lives?
No, that probably will happen, but it's dangerous. The fact that we're at a place to where people think it is okay to question the will of voters, that is dangerous. And for the president of the United States to spew this type of rhetoric, it's irresponsible of him, and it's a total disrespect to the office.
So there have been talks. This is not new. There have been talks for years about issues with the country's electoral college and just the electoral college in general, but also how it underrepresents minorities and lower income communities. Do you think there's a possibility that this election might spark some change in our system when it comes to electoral college? Should it?
Well, here's my thing. I believe when our forefathers, when they created, you know, how the checks and balances should be done in this country, they did it in a way for a reason. And so, yeah, I believe that. I mean, should we relook at how things should be done because times have changed? Of course. But then we have to also be careful that we're not diverting away from the checks and balances that exist that keeps America America.
So I'm wondering, you know, what conversations have you had with fellow electors about these issues that, you know, they might see, you know, problems with the system? Do they feel the same way as you do? Is there a conversation about possibly changing the system? Again, specifically when dealing with the Electoral College.
No, I have not heard. Those conversations have not been had. The conversations that I know that are being had is from the top of our conversation, and that is the trying to derail our democracy. That's the conversation that's happening in the circles of people that I'm speaking to.
Again, I'm talking with Democratic Broward County State Representative Chevron Jones. He is a member of the Electoral College. Members are meeting today, expected to vote in President-elect Joe Biden. We'll have special coverage tonight from NPR at 8 p.m. when President-elect Biden is expected to speak. Again, as we mentioned, though, President Trump won Florida by a lot. I want to move from national politics to statewide issues. I mean, we have a little bit of time before the legislative session begins, but, you know, we have to talk about what's going to be happening. There are a lot of new faces, you know, in the legislature, still Republican, though, in both chambers and, of course, the governor's office. What kind of confidence do you have that progressive policies have any chance in this legislature?
Well, that's a good question, Lewis, and considering that I'm moving from the House over into the Senate now, and knowing that the work that needs to be done, there's a lot of COVID work that's going to be done. But as far as progressive policies are concerned, yeah, it's according to what type of policies are we talking about? Are we talking about Medicare for all? Are we talking about looking at how we can hold accountability for police officers? So all of these things are on the table that has come from our policies that has come from our side. But you have my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who they see this different, to where we might look at accountability for police officers. They label it as defunding the police. Or we might talk about Medicare for all or Medicaid expansion or anything that will give individuals access to health care. And then they label us as being socialist. And so, yeah, it's going to take us putting everything to the table so they know where we're coming from in this age of COVID. Are we really socialist because you want to give individuals access to health care? Are you really defunding the police when you're trying to bring accountability measures in place? And so there's a play on words that's happening that I believe that we're going to have to deal with in this legislative session, and that we're going to have to call them out on the things that they're trying to call us out on.
All right. Well, there's that. But at some point, like any legislature, you probably have to find some compromise somewhere. Where do you think there's a chance for that?
Absolutely, there is. And I will say this, that as it pertains to, I think, Senate President Simpson, he's setting up his chambers to do just that. I mean, you have individuals like Senator Pizzo, who is the chair for the Criminal Justice Committee over in the Senate. You got individuals like Senator Lauren Book, who is a chair of a committee. So I believe that they're trying to do their best to create a space to have these conversations. But the question is, when the rubber meets the road, are they really willing to have this real conversation to bring the change that's needed for the 21 million people in the state of Florida? I'm walking in optimistic and hoping I can maintain that even when we get there in January for committee weeks.
And for you, I mean, you probably mentioned a couple of the big ones for you, but I'm just wondering, like, for you, what's the real goal? What are some of the ones that you're really pushing for?
I'll be honest with you. One of the main things that I'm going to be pushing for, it's actually two of them. I am going to push for the access to health care. So many people have lost their jobs. Emergency rooms are packed with people who are going to get checkups because they don't have health insurance anymore. So that's one thing that I'm going to be working along with Representative Duran on. And the last thing that we're going to have to deal with is COVID response for small businesses. The Senate District 35, where I represent, it is the hub of small businesses within that area. And so, yeah, I'm going to work along with Senator Manny Diaz to figure out what we can do to bring support and help to the small businesses within the communities because they need it.
I don't know if this is something that's crossed your mind, and maybe I'm putting it in there, but I'm wondering your thoughts. One of the challenges you may face is the fact that President Trump will become a voter, a taxpayer of Florida. He's a resident of Florida, a civilian again, and some of his family also moving to South Florida. Is there any concern that he may still try to play a role in politics? He does have a lot of support, especially from the governor.
I can tell you that Donald Trump is not the least of my concerns, and I don't think the country rejected him, and I know he's coming to Florida. I know he won Florida, quote unquote. He's not going to be the concern of mine, or I'm sure some of my other colleagues, as we try to bring help to the people who need it. He's run this country in the ground enough.
There are calls for the chair of the Democratic Party in Florida, Terry Rizzo, to resign following the poor showing in the November election. Do you think there's time for new leadership?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Terry, she put a statement out, and Terry understands that, there are some mistakes that happen, and because of that, she's stepping aside for new leadership to be able to happen. And I think, we're moving in that direction after doing some assessments and realizing that, we need to move in a new direction. It's true. The Democrats, we are a big tent party. But being a big tent party also it requires us to make sure that we're not excluding people within this big tent, making sure everyone has access to be able to share what they believe is needed for us to move the party forward. And I think that's the direction that we need to move in.
But let me come back to something you just said. I'm just curious. What did the party do wrong? How did you, you didn't lose you lost by a lot more than you did 4 years before. And you lost some big seats in Congress. And even in the state legislature, what did you do wrong?
Well, I think, Lewis, to be honest with you, one of the things I believe we did wrong, we allow the Republicans to label us as something that we weren't, and we didn't fight back hard enough. For instance, we did not fight hard enough when they were calling us socialists. We could have fought harder on that. When they spoke about defunding the police, we could have spoke out and totally said what it meant by when we're talking about when the word defund the police, when we say it, what it means, talking about accountability, talking about to reallocating funds to other services to take the load off police officers. So we didn't do enough to push back on a lot of those things. And I think that we have to do that. And I'll say this. The last thing is we have a responsibility to make sure that the only time that we're not engaging people is during election time. We have to engage people 365 days of the year and not use them just for their vote. We have to let them know that we are concerned about who you are and your civic engagement throughout the year. And that's important for us to do. And we made a mistake on that.
Do you have anybody in mind who should take over?
Well, I've already put my support around Manny Diaz. So that's where my support is at.
All right. On that note, I'll leave it at that. Democratic Broward County State Representative going to the Senate, Chevron Jones, joining us. Again, he is part of the Electoral College. Today, the Electoral College nationwide voting in President-elect Joe Biden. Mr. Jones, always a pleasure. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
And by the way, just a note, those expecting Congresswoman Frederica Wilson on the show today, she had to cancel last minute. We had to get her. We'll try to get her again for a future program. But still to come, climate change, affordable housing, and the future of Miami Beach. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami Beach has an affordable housing problem. That's not news. But sea rise could make it worse, according to a new study. Analysis from the organization Climate Central found that the carbon pollution that leads to a warmer planet will mean more sea rise, and that puts coastal subsidized housing at risk, and in the front lines for routine flooding. Also, the coveted view of an ocean front continues to hike up prices, leaving some with no choice but to leave home. WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich joins us now with this investigation. Jenny, great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
All right. So how, I mean, we talk about affordable housing in Miami Beach, not new news, but how is sea level rise now making housing even worse in Miami Beach?
Well, we knew that sea rise in Miami Beach is a problem, right? It's a barrier island. It's kind of the tip of the spear for flooding from sea rise down here. And so now you have these sort of colliding problems of affordable housing, an extreme shortage, and sea rise that makes that affordable housing more expensive in many ways and kind of less inhospitable to live in, right?
Yeah. Now, look, some people have been here long enough. They remember Miami Beach used to be affordable, but that changed. When did it all change? How did it change?
Well, so I talked to former Mayor Maddie Bauer, and she says that it started with the renovation and restoration of the Art Deco district. As you mentioned, Miami Beach was one time affordable. I remember going there after college, and the verandas of the old Art Deco buildings were lined with senior citizens, and it was just an affordable place to live. The rents were cheap. But when they renovated and attracted new renters, new tenants in these lovely old buildings, prices shot up and a lot of those people got displaced.
And isn't it interesting? The architecture actually played a role. Protecting that architecture has played a role in making it so pricey.
Right, right. I mean, it is beautiful architecture. It was part of the reason why it was preserved. It's a lovely place.
So there was a push going back in the 1990s for more affordable housing. What was happening, and was it enough?
Right. So what Maddie Bauer told me is that the Preservation League actually pivoted. They had an arm that enticed investors to put money into preserving the district, and they then pivoted to buying older buildings to set aside and preserve for affordable housing. They became subsidized units, and they have about 12 buildings now altogether. City of Miami Beach also has some public housing units, but there was this, I mean, that was a commitment they made to the senior citizens that, you know, sort of wants to find the beach.
Yeah. Let's talk about one of these places at risk. I believe it's called Villa Maddie, just off Collins Avenue. Tell me a little bit of the history of this place. What's the story?
Right. So that was a newly built building, and it was named in honor of a former Mayor Bauer, Villa Maddie. And it is located just off Collins Avenue in the 2800 block. It's a really vulnerable area to flooding. It is newer, so there's parking on the ground floor, but right in front of it is another building, Villa Maria, that the Miami Beach Community Redevelopment Corporation also owns, and that's at ground level. So that part of the city, you know, gets some pretty heavy duty flooding. And according to the Climate Central report, it could face five times a year, flooding events up to five times a year by 2050.
So what does the future look like for a place like this, for this particular, like buildings like this one?
Well, so, I mean, the future looks wet, right?
Yeah, well, more flooding, this is true. I'm wondering, like, you know what, like, for example, why not just build more units?
Well, there is a density issue. I talked to Miami Beach's city planner, Tom Rooney, and he explained that you know, the Miami Beach is sort of like the Keys. When there are hurricanes and storms and emergencies, you have to evacuate. There are only a few ways on and off. The Keys has like one way, but Miami Beach, you know, just has the causeways. So you can't make it a super dense, you can't increase density because then that endangers evacuations.
Yeah. And another person that you talked to was Anne Ray from the University of Florida, and she's been studying Florida housing for a couple of decades. And after the recession, Miami-Dade added a bunch of rental units. And here's what she said, that not all of them were affordable.
Supply of rental housing was really expanding, but the supply of low-cost rental housing was contracting. And at the exact same time, the county was adding both lower-income and higher-income renters. So the availability of that affordable supply for lower-income renters was really shrinking.
All right, so Jenny, I mean, how has this affected where we are and put us in the situation where we are now?
Well, so we have a lot, as she said, a lot more affordable units. And I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all that clip. Okay. But so we added about 100,000, but they were all they weren't considered affordable. The rent was over $1,000 a month. At the same time, the recession, we had a lot more renters, you know, with the recession and the housing collapse. People no longer had credit or could afford to buy a property, and it was expensive. So the share of renters increased pretty dramatically, and that increased demand, which then, you know, drives up the cost of rent. So that's put us in a place where she says we actually lost 45,000 affordable places to live, even though we dramatically added to the number.
Why build affordable housing along the coast? Why not go more inland where it might be cheaper?
Well, I mean, that's a good question and a hard one to answer. You want to have affordable housing near where people work, right? You don't want to have them driving hours to get back and forth to work. Some people would argue, but if it's so expensive, then, you know, which is worse, the commute or the expense?
Right.
But you can't. And what Mayor Bauer had said to me was it also goes to, you know, the richness and diversity of a community. Right. I mean, you don't want one kind of community. You want. And there is a historic connection. That's what she said, that why their commitment was so strong is because they had displaced senior citizens when they renovated a lot of these buildings, and they have a place there. So,
yeah. Again, talking with WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich about her new series about affordable housing and climate change. She worked with Climate Central reporter Iarella Horn-Mueller on the nonprofit media outlet Southerly, and they cover the intersection of ecology and justice and culture in the American South. Now, you can find a link to the story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial, or go to the website WLRN.org. Now, as you said, Jenny, you've been talking with Maddie Bauer. She served three terms as Miami Beach mayor. She's lived on the beach for 40 years.
They're using that to say we need to tear down to build new and then get condominium and get a higher rent or a higher price for the condominium. And they don't want anybody speaking out and saying it is your fault. You should be asking for affordable housing.
I thought this was fascinating, that basically there are people saying that they're using the excuse of the sea level rise to build more expensive housing. What's the argument there?
Right. So she sits on the Housing Authority Board, and she is very critical of the local government of Miami Beach for not insisting that more affordable housing be built. And she sees it as sea rises, as she said, an excuse to tear down buildings, these older buildings. You know, they're a lot of garden style, ground level apartments or two-story, little three-story buildings. And she says people will make the argument, well, you've got to fortify those against sea rise. That means elevate them. That's a tricky thing to do. Let's tear them down, build new buildings. They're doing some of that at the north end of the beach. And when you build new, the price goes up.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people rent in the area. But what effect would the, you know, building more expensive housing have on those folks?
You mean the people who are already in buildings?
Yeah, the people who, I mean, you know, again, it's the ones who are renting, not the ones whose buildings might get knocked down, but just the ones who are already living there. These bigger buildings around them.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the landlord could look around and say, everybody else is getting higher rents. Why don't I jack up my rent?
Mm,
I mean, I don't know. You know, a city planner would probably have a lot to say about this, but you don't want to leave people living in old buildings that with maintenance problems. Clearly, you have to find a way to both maintain or build new, but not make the pricing, you know, out of reach for your workforce.
Yeah. Another person you spoke with was Ahmed Martin, I believe, the executive director of the Miami Beach Community Redevelopment Corporation.
In Miami Beach, it's a perfect storm, no pun intended, because our proximity and risk underwriting for insurance is getting more strict. And therefore it's increasing costs because of the frequency and the intensity of the storms. We pay almost three times as much per unit per year than a portfolio, a similar portfolio of a similar size in other areas of Miami-Dade County and in other areas of the country.
I think about, Jenny, the fact we had this just strange hurricane season. We got lucky here in South Florida, but, you know, more storms, cost is going to go up, flooding insurance, storm insurance, all of this is going to go up. Is there a way to make coastal living affordable at all in Miami Beach? Is it impossible now?
Well, you have to figure out the insurance cost, right? I mean, that's what he's saying. I was surprised that it was three times as much as on the mainland. I didn't realize it was that much higher. Maybe I'm just naive, but the National Flood Insurance Program has got to figure out a way to properly work. It's not working now. But do you ask the federal government to subsidize risky building or risky areas that there are people, I think a lot of people would say that's a bad idea. Insurance on in a risky area is always going to be high. So what do you do to keep affordable housing low? And what do you do for the workforce that can't afford those super high rates?
I wonder, with all the people you spoke with on this story and just, you know, all the research you've been doing for years now, that What do people tell you? What do they think the future is going to look like? Will there be a day when it's just impossible to have affordable housing on Miami Beach?
You know, I think it depends on who you talk to. There are a lot of people in the real estate industry and developers who are and city government officials who believe we'll find a way to engineer our way out of it. Once those engineering fixes become better, then maybe those insurance rates stop increasing. And then there are a lot of people who think that it is just, like you said, or the question you asked, you know, not wise to keep building in such risky places to live. And there's a really good book called The Geography of Risk by Gilbert Gall that talks about the history of coastal development. I mean, this is not something that happened with climate change. Climate change, like it does with everything, is clearly amplifying the problem. Yeah. But the role that the government has played in allowing building in risking places over time, it goes back years.
Because it's so seductive. It's a beautiful place to live. Everybody wants to be there. Why not, right?
Well, I know. We all always want to. I'm one of those people, too. I don't live on the water, but boy, it would be nice.
yeah, I know. Well, yeah, at the rate we're going, maybe in 50 years, the water will be right next to me. Again, I'm talking with WLRN's environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Check out her new series. Find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial or go to the website WLRN.org. You spoke with a lot of people in this series. Another one was Gregorio Lopez. He lives in Miami Beach. He's 81 years old.
I can't afford a big rent because my check is not too much. I cannot pay $600 or $500 or $400 because $400 is almost half what I get.
I mean, it just sounds like, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it just sounds like it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable for people like Lopez that eventually they won't be able to do it.
Right. And unless there's some assistance for them. I mean, here's somebody who came to the beach 40 years ago. He worked in hotels. He worked at the Delano. He worked in a couple of other hotels. He became a pharmacist assistant. He actually lived in a friend's hotel, he said, for free for a little while. I talked to somebody whose grandparents used to own hotels on the beach, and she said that they actually set units aside for the staff to live in to keep the costs affordable.
And let me also be careful, too, because I know we've been saying seniors a lot, and that's a big part of the story. But there are also a lot of workers, who they can't afford to live on Miami Beach, but that's where their job is. Miami Beach needs these folks. Is there an effort to try to provide them with something, an opportunity, or no?
There is. I mean, the city of Miami Beach is trying to create more affordable housing, but there's only so much they can control. Like last year, the state lawmakers passed a law that mandated that local governments could not require workforce housing in development. So that made it tougher. The city of Miami Beach recently produced a plan, though, in historic neighborhoods where they do have more control. And they're looking at two neighborhoods in Flamingo Park and the Collins Waterfront, where they're trying to incentivize developers. So while the state, you know, ban says you can't mandate it, you can't encourage it. So they're looking for ways to, you know, increase the square footage by offering them, we'll let you, I forget the way it was worded exactly. I'm sorry, again, a city planner. But that would allow more smaller units to try and keep prices down. And you're right. I mean, for my story, we looked at subsidized housing, and that is mostly occupied by seniors. But at the north end of the beach, which still has a lot of older garden style apartments, that's a whole workforce area. I mean, there are definitely a lot of workers and workforce housing on the beach that's not subsidized that could get swallowed up by this effort to make buildings more resilient, because that increases the cost. I talked to another group called Enterprise Community, which is a national nonprofit housing organization, and they're doing a program. It's in Miami, but it could next year, but it could work in Miami Beach too, where they will sort of do an audit for property owners. Like, they want you to come to them, show them your property. They'll go through and list all the things that you can do to upgrade the property, because part of the push too is it's still cheaper to maintain the existing buildings than it is to build new ones. And there's also an argument, especially for subsidized housing, that it's awfully hard to build public housing in neighborhoods. There is this awful, you know, NIMBYism and stuff. Yeah. So I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. And you even pointed out too in the stories, it's developers. And how many developers have that in their heart to want to, you know, build affordable housing when there's so much opportunity? You know, I wanted to touch on this real briefly. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava campaigned on addressing affordable housing, but what can she do?
Well, again, there are things you can do to incentivize developers and offer them perks. Just last week, I believe, she was part of the University of Miami rolled out a new part of their housing affordability project that actually includes data on, let's see, it's future flooding from sea rise, current flooding, and storm surge, so that you can literally pinpoint areas in the county where there's, you can look at the affordable housing, the housing costs there, you can see neighborhoods where maybe it's affordable now, and look at the flood risk. So you can work with developers to try and maintain that housing, but also flood proof it. And that is a goal. I mean, this is tricky though. You got to convince developers that this is in their best interest to do this.
And there's incentivizing developers. What about, is there a possibility of incentivizing landlords?
So that's part of that Enterprise Community project that I mentioned, where they'll go in and they'll work with landlords. And what they told me is they understand that you have to make these fixes affordable and attainable. You know, you can't go in and tell people, you know, give them a list of options that just is not financially feasible for them. Yeah. There are landlords that, you know, wealthy landlords, and then there's just landlords who are making a living running buildings.
Right. So, you know, this again, if you didn't get the chance to listen to the story today, this morning, it's going to play again this afternoon and All Things Considered. And this is part of a 2-part series. It's 2 7-minute pieces. You can hear the other one tomorrow, and you can always go online, WLRN.org, to check it out. But, you know, Jenny, I wanted to ask you, as usual, you probably gathered hours of tape and a lot of conversations that you didn't get to put in the story. So I'm wondering, oh my God, what did you find that you had to leave out that would also be a story in of itself?
I feel like I wish I could have found more Gregorio Lopez's. One of the problems with the pandemic is getting to people to talk to them. I'm old school. I like to go knock on doors and talk to people. And when I went to some of the buildings that were identified, and especially because it's senior housing, you know, you just couldn't get in. So I would have loved to have talked to more people. And if anybody is listening and this is an issue for them, please reach out to me because this is going to be an ongoing story.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, find us. You can email us. You can email Jenny. Jenny, give out your email. You're here now. Do it.
Oh, okay, it's long.
That's okay.
J Staletovich, so JSTALETOVICH at WLRN News, so WLRNNEWS.org.
You know, you can always send it to her. You can always just find us too on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'll connect you with her again if you want to share your story as well. Again, the two-part series, part one aired today. It'll air again at All Things Considered. Part two airs tomorrow. Find out more at WLRN.org. Jenny, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Again, the WLRN environment reporter Jenny Staletovich. Well, still to come, we're going to go back and look through the Sundial Book Club. It hasn't been around for a while, but we're still reading. Are you? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So what have you been reading over the last couple of months? Tell me. Let me know. I want to hear. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, Sundial Book Club. I want to know what kind of books you've been reading because we haven't had a Sundial Book Club title in a little while, but we will be bringing it back in 2021. You think back to what we've done this year. I mean, we've had some amazing authors and read some really cool books. We went on a walk across Florida with Kent Russell in the book, The Land of Good Living. We taught you how to handle grief and stress in Leslie Streeter's Black Widow. And we went back in time to the 1926 hurricane in the Florida Keys with Chanel Cleeton's The Last Train to Key West. And remember, you can listen back to all of our Sundial Book Club interviews. Just go to our website, search Sundial Book Club, join the Facebook group again, Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you. And tell us about, again, what you're reading. We will have a new book for you in January. But let's revisit a conversation from last year about the famous book from Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Were Watching God. We were speaking with N.Y. Nathiri. She's the executive director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community Incorporated and the general manager of the annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities.
We say that for Zora Neale Hurston and the Eatonville community, there is a symbiotic relationship. If you look at your hand, you have two sides. And on one side, we say there is Zora Neale Hurston. And on the other side, there is the town of Eatonville because, or as she's called it, her village, her home village, her native village. Zora Neale Hurston is a charismatic writer, folklorist, and anthropologist. And what she did in her writing was to really bring to life the primary research that she dedicated her life to in documenting the folkways and the traditions of people of African ancestry in the rural South, in the Caribbean, and elsewhere. And so in her literature, there's a continual reference to the people of Eatonville and the community of Eatonville. In fact, Zora Neale Hurston has made Eatonville popularly known as the oldest incorporated African-American municipality in the United States. And because of the dynamism and her fantastic storytelling, in fact, Eatonville has become and is an internationally recognized literary destination.
For people who haven't been, you know, this is a small town that's just a few miles away from Orlando. How do you describe it to people?
We describe Eatonville as a jewel, a treasure that is representative of unique small town Americana. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the condensed Reader's Digest. Years and years ago, there would be a standing article or component of that publication that featured out of the way or little known treasures of Americana, places that you might stumble on, and once you had visited, you were just really enamored with the place. Eatonville is that historically significant part of the American saga. Maybe little known, but because of Zora Neale Hurston, celebrated because of its history, its heritage, and its culture.
You have an interesting connection to Zora Neale Hurston. Please tell us about it.
Well, in fact, I'm assuming you're referencing my mother. She she knew Zora Neale Hurston as a child, and in fact, she and her sisters are referenced as the pretty Johnson girls in one of Zora Neale Hurston's folklore collections, Mules and Men. And so Zora Neale Hurston was a part of my family lore as I was growing up, because my grandmother would talk about her and about how she was a famous person. In part, my grandmother did that because she wanted to instill in us that just because we came from a little community, it did not mean that we could not accomplish wonderful things.
When did you start reading her work?
Honestly, I started reading Zora Neale Hurston's work after the birth of my first child. So I was 25 or 26. I knew Zora Neale Hurston's folk tales from my grandmother because she would tell them as a part of our, bedtime stories. But I did not read Their Eyes Were Watching God until I think I was probably 26. I read it when it was a Penguin classic that cost 99 cents. The book now retails for, I think it is $14.95.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, and thinking about, again, you know, the stories you grew up listening to your relatives about Zora Neale Hurston, how did that shape the way you read Their Eyes Were Watching God?
In fact, I was very comfortable in reading it, and I say that because on a consistent basis, we hear teachers and sometimes readers say that they are a little bit uncomfortable initially with the dialect. Zora Neale Hurston writes Their Eyes Were Watching God in narrative, but she is recognized as a master of the use of dialect as lyrical language. And so for me, there was not a difficulty. And we always say to people, if you read it aloud, don't trouble yourself with the apostrophes. But if you read it aloud, you will really understand it very easily, because it is the language without the D's, the T's, and the E's necessarily, but easily understood because the word, what's being written, translates, as it were, into comprehensible English.
And, you know, of course, the big question, too, is how accurate she was in depicting life at the time in Eatonville and depicting Eatonville in the story.
In fact, the folklorists, and this is when we talk about folklorists, we mean people who are trained in the gathering of primary material, source material about folkways, about the people's life. Zora Neale Hurston said that she was most interested, and this was her direct quote, in the Negro furthest down. And so she was very meticulous about the collecting that she did. As a matter of fact, she references the fact that she would repeat stories to her listeners again and again to make sure that she was being very accurate. Now, the folklorists acknowledge Zora Neale Hurston as one of the first practitioners of that craft, and say, were it not for the primary research material that she gathered, we would not have the authentic traditions, the folkways of the rural Southern African American.
I'm talking with N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, Inc. We're discussing the life of Zora Neale Hurston and her time in Eatonville, Florida. You know, every year there's this festival to honor her. Where do people come from to learn about, you know, about Zora Neale Hurston and her life? And what's that like?
Well, we say that the Zora Festival, and that's that is the brand that has come from that long name of Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities. We say that the Zora Festival actually has three goals, and they have been the same since the first festival presentation in 1990. That is to celebrate the life and work of Zora Neale Hurston, to celebrate the historic significance of her hometown, Eatonville, as a historic African-American community, and to celebrate the cultural contributions which people of African ancestry have made to the United States and to world culture. So, yes, the name of this special event is in her honor, but it does not mean that each and every one of the festivals focuses solely on Zora Neale Hurston. Now, for example, this past festival, which was our 30th, it was January 26th through the 3rd of February. We had people literally from all over the world. Because this was our milestone event, we called it the global celebration. And in fact, that is what happened. The University of Central Florida here in Orlando hosted the 13th annual biennial conference of the Collegium for African American Research, which is a European-based group of scholars. They came to the university in helping us to celebrate the 30th anniversary, mm-hmm. and the University of Central Florida hosted them specifically because it is our major academic partner here in the Orlando area. Of course, we have relationships with Rollins College and Valencia College and Seminole State, but the University of Central Florida is the longest standing relationship that we've had. Yeah. In addition, the World Conference of Mayors brought delegations here from West Africa, from South America, from the Caribbean, and of course from cities around the United States. And historic Black colleges and universities held a summit hosted by our organization through Spelman College and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. So for this milestone event, literally people came from all over the world.
Again, N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, Inc., and the General Manager of the annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities. And again, the book, you know, it, really one of the beautiful classics, American classics, Their Eyes Were Watching God, a wonderful read. N.Y. Nathiri, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And remember, you can find any of our old conversations of the Sundial Book Club. Go to the website, WLRN.org. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Find us on Facebook at the Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you've been reading over the holidays. We are going to be back with a new title in January. And that is Sundial for this Monday, December 14th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And by the way, the music that you hear throughout the program is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Don't forget, if you miss the show, you can always catch the rebroadcast or just find the podcast. Search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, vaccines are on the way to hospitals across South Florida. Who's going to get them first? And is there any reluctance among healthcare workers to take it? Plus, we're going to bring you some virtual vaudeville with award-winning performer Taylor Mack. His show, Taylor Mack's Holiday Sauces, mixes music, theater, and film, and more, and it's available now. And by the way, we've been hearing from you on our social media about our conversation earlier on the show. We were talking about affordable housing and climate change in Miami Beach. We were talking with WLRN environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. We heard from Bridges Meniorachi on Twitter. Hope I said that right, Bridges. I'm sorry. He says, if you can't make the rent affordable, make transportation efficient and affordable. We need better transportation. transportation to reach West Palm Beach and Homestead. With that, we can create new affordable communities. Trains are better now, but still incipient. Thank you so much. You can always again find us on Facebook or Twitter. Post your comments there at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.